So we have two things we'd like to talk about tonight, the next few minutes, Marshall. And one is three or four generic observations you would make. First, for the hospital or medical people in Atlantic City, and then after that, for the Time Incorporated seminar dry run on the 25th. So we're asking initially what would be the essential message, three or four principal points which you would like to see communicated to these medicos and hospital managers and representatives.
Well, that's a bit presumptuous, but the theme that we've often discussed, Ralph, is that the business of a hospital is to save the patient's time. It's not to make people well. It's to get them out of there in 3 days instead of 3 weeks if possible, just as the teacher's business is to save the student's time. Anybody can learn anything if he has long enough, but the teacher's job is to accelerate the learning process to the point where he can really save some time. But perhaps in hospitals in general, the older pattern that had grown up unconsciously was strong centralizing of functions, services, and the new pattern tends to be exactly the opposite, strong decentralizing of services and functions. And service industries in general tend to take this pattern because their job is, after all, tailor-made, custom-oriented toward the needs of the individual. A centralized service or center is naturally slanted toward the needs of the administration rather than of the patient. And for example, the whole new stress in somebody like Dick Grantley Reed's, you know, Childbirth Without Fear, the whole reversal takes the form of considering the patient rather than the, well, I suppose, the convenience of the doctor, or even taking a father into consideration as undergoing trauma during childbirth. But I think that general reversal of direction, the decentralizing, moving hospital services toward the needs of the patient away from the advantage and consideration of the staff, is a pattern which affects all forms of industry and of service and organization of energy in our time. It's quite a surprising reversal.
I think, interestingly, from what I've been able to observe, it seems to be the interest of the patient and the doctor as opposed to the institution.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well,
that's a good point.
Yeah. And the doctor had identified earlier with the institution than the patient had. So he tended to be a little more.
More recognition of both of them.
Yeah.
The doctor won't come out. He's, there's this difference. An interesting thing in relation to time when you speak of the hospitals, how in one sense the hospitals are still functioning under pre-electric conditions,
mm-hmm.
and that goes in terms of electric light. Mm-hmm. Why do they get patients up early in the morning? Mm-hmm. The whole scheduling of doing everything is related to the days before electricity, electric light. The whole time question you speak of.
That's a good point, Tony. That it's not any longer necessary to set the gears according to daytime, but time can be programmed according to electric light.
My wife used to be especially vehement about this when we were both working for General Electric, Tony, and she was in a research and development sector. And she used to say to the management there, look, General Electric people, you have literally transformed day and night. by the sheer provenance of that electric bulb up there, and why do you insist upon adhering to the calendar and the chronology of something that has by itself become a kind of anachronism, where actually you can rescore and rescale the day to suit human convenience and not to adhere to a time-honored and people's favorite system, so to speak?
This tendency to decentralize and therefore to bring all services within the range of the individual rather than of the administrator is characteristic of many areas of electric servicing, including the book, you see, with xerography. The reader becomes publisher instead of the publisher becoming the centralized service agency.
You know, in that light, I was thinking in relation to the packaging problem that the reader can become the producer of the user can become the producer of the package with electricity. The consumer can have the machine and determine the package he wants. He can electrically question the packaging company. They can electrically supply the answer, which is made in his own plant, in his own place.
Yeah.
It is almost similar. The beginnings of this go back to the roll of wrapping paper, you know, which was an attempt to send out packaging here. Form your own packaging by hand, but now it can be done the same design and custom making of a package. One could type in their needs to the company, and the company electrically send back the full.
There is an amazing new possibility too, you see, in the as a result of cellophane transparency. When the packaging becomes transparent, the contained objects have to take on a new dimension. They're so visible regardless of whether they're wrapped or not. They have to have a new character. They have to be more acceptable in their rough and ready form, as it were. And cellophane, the translucency in packaging creates a completely new dimension, and it's not unrelated to sound, because sound is more
packaging.
You hear these ads for the meat and the AMP, they say the worst side is up.
And now the oranges have to become more orangey, the apples have to become more apple-y, so to speak, and everything has to take on a coloration that even transcends that's what it had in nature in the first place.
I'm sure that it's worth meditating a bit on this strange dimension of translucency for wrapping paper. It has, in many examples, though, reached a state of great inconvenience. Have you ever noticed how difficult it is to remove cellophane from many products? Darned hard. You need a razor blade to even touch the stuff. They haven't quite accepted.
Especially when
unwrapping can become embarrassing, too.
Especially when seeing on with one of those objects that looks like the old curly iron.
Yes,
the girls
yes.
used to use them in their hair, and they brush it across, and it.
But it becomes a noisy thing that becomes embarrassing. Really sound.
In public.
But to return to another point, Marshall, what would you say apropos of the hospital and the doctors, staff, and administration about environment and anti-environment, about the world in which they dwell, but which they cannot see?
Part of the revolution of modern medicine is that most hospital space, 38% of all hospital space, is reserved for patients recovering from therapy. And therapy, as therapy takes on tremendous new dimensions, it also lays low many more patients than formerly. And so the largest proportion of all hospital services are occupied helping people recover from treatment.
Which they've already had.
Which treatment which has been already given to them. So that such is the potency of antibiotics and these various prophylactics and so on, but they lay low most patients.
It's interesting. In light of this, if we notice this idea of publishing becoming individual, there seems to be much more outpatient treatment, of treatment of the patients in the home, in the within their own community.
And through the druggist.
And through the druggist, and through the interestingly, when you say that, I was thinking through drugs, but the druggist becomes the same thing.
Right.
For instance, like Saranac used to be a place people went for a TB. No longer exists,
right.
You know?
Now houses a management school, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, well, that's another example of decentralizing, isn't it, of medication services and therapy. The possibility, well, even, of course, aspirin and whatnot permits decentralization, extremist form.
It's interesting, the manufacturing of drugs takes on that role.
LSD, however, is a drug being used for the therapy of people afflicted by environments. It's a cure for environmental malaise and saturation. It yanks you out of the environment as if on a trip.
Yeah.
And this kind, extending the drugs all the way into the psychic domain, is a curious one. I'm not sure how far it is to be taken seriously or sanctioned, how far to be implored or deplored. However, I think we've covered the beat about the hospital. The whole tendency is this decentralizing. As many, many services become available in many, many places, there's not the same need to rush off the hospital. On the other hand, notice that one of the overwhelming facts about hospital is that it's team play. That the medical man goes to the hospital because he can depend upon elaborate teamwork to aid him in any therapy, whatever. It's no longer, it's not only decentralized, but it's corporate rather than private activity.
And it really has precipitated and even sanctioned, as Benny Mullertime would say, new work forms where men cohere and collaborate intelligently on a single problem,
mm-hmm.
so that the original fragmentation of the work or of the operation.
Well,
right?
Bernie's point, too, was that in the operating room you have a high level of coordinated, orchestrated team play.
Right.
Whereas in the area of ordinary hospital care, you have the more obsolete types of organized or malorganized functions.
Then there's a kind of rude disparity within the organization of the hospital itself, as between the coordinating team of surgeons, which is streamlined and immediate and intelligently coordinated, versus the rather serialized, routine, old-fashioned kind of approach to...
In other words, the operating room is run operationally,
right.
And the patient care is run bureaucratically.
One is made to save time, and the other is made to spend time.
All right.
Right.
Very good. Let's switch over.
Could we stop for a moment?
Sure.
Yeah.
No, I don't want to put those observations down. For
no, but this is completely private, Marshall, and it's to the point, actually, because this helped provide the...
Well, it was only yesterday that we were having words from another type of organization in which they pointed out their horror, lest they become bureaucratized and rigid and brittle and lose their flexibility.
Right.
And today we were living with the same, those very unfortunate characteristics, a highly skilled and highly expert bunch.
But a very narrow expertise.
That had begun to be self-complacent and self-satisfied, and which had no power, self-criticism or self-observation, no power of flexibility, innovation. And in other words, a bunch of people who just about had it.
Does this come in any way from their relation to print?
and hi-fi photography.
Marshall felt very, very uncomfortable with these people, with the same kind of sensitivity that you have.
That's what I told you.
Yeah, right.
They were not unfriendly. They were only too eager.
They're very personable. These are good guys, you know.
And in life at home, fine. Yeah. But you're not dealing with them at home.
Precisely.
You're dealing with them in an area that they are holding on to.
That's
and
right.
The freewheeling receptiveness we found at this other organization, where there was an eager exchange and a subtle byplay and a quick apprehension of what Marshall was driving at, and then a rejoinder and a question and a dialogue.
You know,
none of this.
Interestingly, you would find response at Look or at the Herald Tribune, but not at Time.
Uh-huh.
Let's be explicit. Look was what we were talking to.
Oh, see, I can see it in the magazine.
Yeah.
You see, they are, life is lost. Life is deadly.
Right.
Life is lost at this time.
Life is death.
Life is a horrible magazine at this point. It's not revealing anything. It's trying to perpetuate a
dead past.
It's trying to perpetuate their own ideas instead of looking at life and getting ideas,
right.
As opposed to Look, which is opening up as a magazine.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I just can see it in the pages, and that's why I said you wouldn't find this there without knowing anything.
You two are very sensitive men. This is exactly what has been haunting Marshall these few days. We've been talking to both these people, Marshall as principal here, and the verve, the reciprocity, the sense of exploration and vitality.
Life magazine.
But he found
not,
the one.
You know, this
was
is
lacking
interesting.
The other.
What are your attitudes and so forth to photography? What do you think about the picture?
Oh well, it's many. It's many dimensions. It's many kinds of things, and of course, right here the pictures on your wall represent a range which could be comprehended within the life orbit, for example, but within their organization as a administrative unit, it's their insistence on keeping those very kinds of pictures in different departments, classified, separate, distinct. They wouldn't allow them to overlap. They'd have exact names and classifications of those pictures. And they've got reached that advanced state of classification which makes dialogue among their enterprises or among their departments very difficult. And so, as we move into the TV age, where the photographic dimensions become rather lo-fi and overlaid, this hi-fi effect becomes alien to their whole needs.
What do you mean by hi-fi?
Well, hi-fi means a lot of fill-in of data, where there's an enormous amount of data filled into the picture, as compared with, say, cartoon, where there's hardly any data, just a bounding line. See, somewhere in between there you have lo-fi. Lo-fi is the world of the old buggy in the fog.
What we saw this afternoon.
Steichen is lo-fi man. He experimented with lo-fi, low definition. Low definition involves the sense of touch. You can feel it. You can handle it. Steichen was a great.
He evokes a response from the perceiver that the hi-fi doesn't, because what we saw this afternoon, and they were pridefully showing this.
Now, let me give you examples right there. The lower picture, the gal. Strong contour in the profile. Above it, strong sense of play and action involvement. Over here on the left, much kinetic, you see, the involvement of the muscular as well as the imagery. That is lo-fi or low definition because it involves the non-visual senses. Where the non-visual senses come into play, touch and action. You know, one of these Polish jokes is about, do you know why Poles are humpback and have flat heads? Because when you ask them a question, they hump their backs, and when they tell them the answer, they flap their head. This is the involvement of the other senses, non-visual. So where the non-visual senses come into play, you have lo-fi photography, which is very satisfying to the ordinary customer. He likes that.
And this afternoon, Marshall and I were taken into a kind of muniment room or a secret storage room where they had these color photographs used to pictorialize the books now in the process of being made. And Tony, the colors screamed at you and the lines leaped out at you, didn't they? One after
another.
Very high
five. Here,
nothing
by the way, this picture over here you see is only partly visual. The posture and the relation of the bodies there is non-visual. It's touch.
Right.
Now, in sound, there are equivalent effects, as you know. And this hi-fi sound would exclude touch or interplay of bodies or interplay of forces and would insist on just one instrument effect at a time. That's fragmentation, that's hi-fi, when you just stress one kind of quality at a time. No dialogue, no interplay. Now, what are we working on?
This, and if I can relate it in sound, this is related to, in sound, to the person being more interested in the sound, or in the old terms, I don't know, the medium, rather than the message. Or I'm using
massage.
No, it is when he's more interested in the in what he's copying than what he's communicating.
Or what effect he's having.
Yes, well, that's what I mean by the when he has no attitude towards or relation to what he's copying. And no point of view in relation, no attitude, I think, is proper. No attitude towards what he's copying. Interestingly, I can show you an interesting example of this. In recordings I have made of foreigners, the foreigners love them. In the recordings that are made by the standard commercial places of foreigners, they hate them. And I'll tell you why. When I have at least realized that in our culture, when I'm recording a song, I want to hear the song. I have an attitude or an approach to the recording of this. Now, if you listen to most recordings of African music and so forth are made by people who do not understand the language. And they see the words just as important as the drum or anything else. And they forget that it's a language. And they forget what there is being communicated by this. And they treat everything as sound, as this getting interest in getting everything clearly. Everything equally and everything clearly. And not they're
knowing the relationship between sound and voice.
I'm in a relationship between the people, what they're trying to say, how people are hearing this, what they are going to get out of it, and so forth. I have an attitude towards it. A relation to it.
You see, Batman is a world of sharp contour, like that lower picture over there, the gal with her white...
That's Rena.
Is it? Mm-hmm. What, you see, there you have a world of contour, sharp outline. That's Batman, which is the world of cartoon rather than the world of pictorial fill-in. And in sound terms, this means the sudden shock or interface of quite distinct sounds. Which that's what I meant when I told you that the soundtrack in Dr. Zhivago is very iconic or cartoon-like. There's no gradation, there's no build-up, there's no gradualness. It's just wham, bang, like a Batman, you know, crunch, zam. What do they call some of those words?
Pow.
Pow.
Oh, yeah. Why didn't the sound go? What'd I do? Oh, maybe this. Yeah, that's on.
Line unmuted.
So just rewind it slightly.
Which that's what I meant when I told you that the soundtrack in Dr. Zhivago was very iconic or cartoon-like. There's no gradation, there's no build-up, there's no gradualness. It's just wham, bang, like a Batman, you know, crunch, zam, boom. What do they call some of those words?
Pow.
Pow. Z-pow. It's tactile. It's interface. Touch means interface. That's what touch is. It's interface. It's not a separate sense. It's the meeting of senses. So when sight and sound meet, you get this sort of cartoon world. That's the mystery, of course, of the cave drawings. Those outlines in the caves have this mysterious power of creating images of enormous involvement. The bounding line on the image is so thick that it brings in the whole human sensorium. The thicker the bounding line, just like the Japanese pen, brings in all the senses, including sound. I think we've had it.
In relation to time, see, the areas I begin to think of is that, you know, how they are going, that they are going into other areas of communication, their books, their audiovisual areas, and I feel that they are going into them without any
understanding.
Real understanding of developing this sensory perception.
Intersensory. They don't want this interplay. They like to keep everything in separate categories.
Oh, Marshall, tell Tony, which I thought was very interesting, about Noam Ross's conception of the new city. Oh, this is rich.
Time is cooperating with a group of builders who are setting up experimental cities.
For the first time in history, literally, Tony, experimental cities.
That is, cities,
from the drawing board to
they're being planned the way a space capsule is planned, as a total human environment. No additional possibilities. Nothing more ever could be added.
Where are these going to be built?
One is in Maryland, halfway between Washington
and they're
Baltimore.
And one's,
yes, yeah.
One's in Irving,
and
California.
I suppose it is an accretion from either political or military structures and products that have to be made, and therefore the surround of the city follows this kind of pattern.
They're dealing with the city as if it were a container corporation dealing with cornflakes.
Yeah.
They deal with people as if they were cornflakes. They figure they can wrap them up, but good. And cut them off from all other contact, so they'll never be touched by the human hand or by human sounds. They will have no communication with the rest of the, say, the American environment. They will really be sealed off.
Really? They'll be, what is their desire?
Oh, well, it's a kind of prepared and controlled environment, you see. Pure art form. Dealing with the city as if it were a museum exhibition of some precious archaeological treasure. And just cut out all the impurities. Just have pure space around this thing.
These are going to be our new ghost towns.
Yeah.
Because it's like the Studio 8H at NBC.
Instead of Aspen.
The most useless place in the world for sound today. because it was designed to isolate, to keep out sound. And these places sound like they're designed to keep out people.
Yeah.
Interestingly enough, and this might give us some reflection here, the first one, midway between Washington and Baltimore, is a political-military complex growing out of the extrusion from Washington and so on. The second one, Tony, is in California, they told us. Irvine.
California, California, 70 miles south of Los Angeles.
Which is a town built around a university which is in the process of being constructed now. The first blush of students moved in last fall, and they will begin to thrive and prosper. And the town, however, is being artfully and purposefully put around the university as the center of culture, of technology, of polity, and of learning. But what I'm driving at here is, in the contemporary scene, the two new cities, at least the ones that Time Inc. have taken for a kind of laboratory experiment for a 5 or 10 year concreative growth, have been a political military one and a university one. I think this in itself is a kind of commentary on what is happening today.
Yeah, and it's very much a theory of purity as opposed to natural mix. And just like your complaint about these sound studios, in which we're designed to keep sounds out, and these cities are designed to keep all life out
and all people in.
I just think very much of someone writing a script for life. And it's focusing on content rather than effect. And things built by desire and not by feeling, by other.
Well, there's nothing wrong with these things as purely experimental matters, but the peculiar.
Will they allow people to move away? I think that's the measure of whether.
Yes, they will.
And
we must concede the fact they agree, although somewhat reluctantly, that people will be allowed to work outside the immediate perimeters of the city. That most of the work will be carried on within the city proper, so that you will have a socio-industrial complex that is sufficient unto itself. But that certainly some of these people will be commuting to Washington or to Baltimore, as the case may be, even though they live within the new city.
You know, I wanted to mention something too that I mentioned to Ralph today. That was that I first began, although I've read you, and my thinking has been affected by your writing, my actions were affected by your talk. I began to use you in my work from the day I heard you. On the first place was your film, but just hearing you, one or two of your lines reached me in a way that I could use. The writing reached me in a way I could think about.
Well, that figures, doesn't it? The written form is very much in that order.
And I, from that, I take the idea that we should begin to think of publishing you in sound.
I think this is something we ought to think about for all books, Tony. That with the coming of Xerox, books ought to acquire the auditory dimension. It's perfectly feasible. And you see, if you ever hear anybody, I'll never forget the time I first heard T.S. Eliot on recording. The disc, on one side he read Grant Hill, on the other side he read The Hollow Man. And when you hear a poet for the first time, that changes everything about his poetry. His rhythms, his involvement in the language changes totally.
Right.
Same with Joyce reading from Anna Lippia.
You know, I've gone through this whole question of poetry and hearing it and so forth. And I begin to think that when you say you should hear poetry, they don't necessarily mean that you should hear someone else read it, but that you should hear it in your head as you read it, as opposed to reading it without verbalizing the words in your head. Poetry is meant to be heard by you in your head.
There's a book that you must have a look at by Francis Berry called The Physical Voice of Poetry. And it's a study of what must have been the sort of sound that the poets heard when they made their own poetry, that is, starting with Chaucer. This book studies what did these poets hear as they composed poetry. What they hear is their own voice in their own heads. This changes their poetry, but completely, depending on what sort of a physical voice they have. And Shelley, for example, had a very shrill voice. So shrill and so raucous that it put his friends off, that even his friends couldn't stand it. Tennyson, on the other hand, had a great booming,
very Overton,
stentorian voice. It was a magnificent organ. And his readers don't get it.
And I'd love to play you this little piece I have. It's about 5 minutes long, on the sound and its relation to the letter form.
Good, let's hear it.
Would you like to hear it?
Love it. But you know, you must read this book. Get the title. It's called The Physical Voice of Poetry.
All right.
By Francis Berry, Berry. And I forgot who published it, but it's not an old. It's not an old book. It's a couple of, 3 years old. And
what was the book by Cage you told me about?
Silence.
Was it called Silence?
Yeah.
Just
Silence.
It's a short book, isn't it?
No, it's a fairly good sized book.
Oh, really? I mistake it.
Beautifully printed.
Well, yeah, okay.
Because I think it might help both of us. Their list, all sorts of things came to mind. And apropos of that, where we were earlier, there's a nice illustration of the effects of the written word on speech in Eliot's Wasteland. And it's the clue or cue comes from his use of the name Mrs. Equitone. But I heard when Eliot reads it, when he's recording the poem, and by the way, there's an area of study, the effects of the poet's recordings in our time have been tremendous. But when he records it, he simply reads the lines, "Tell dear Mrs. Equitone, I bring the horoscope myself. One must be so careful these days." You see, you mimic the effect of typography with the voice, Equitone. You see, even the voices on that tape are close to printing because of the equality. The amount of variation in rhythm and so on is slight compared to any... Well, you take Joyce's opening of his recitation. "Will you know or don't you, Kenneth, or have it told you? Every telling has a tale, and that's the he and the she of it." Now, this is a non-literate speech. The brogues of the world, or dialects of the world, Negro or otherwise, are not affected by print. No leveling off of nuance and pattern, you see. That's why they can perform in the musical world so much more freely than the literate man. But this Mrs. Equitone is really a very useful bit because the whole British upper class mimic, with voice, they mimic the world of printing. This puts the lower classes way down because they still retain many of the characteristics of pre-print in their voices. So the class structure in England is quite simply simulating print with the voice. "Tell dear Mrs. Equitone, I bring the horoscope myself." Boy, does that fix people. It really, you know, puts the clamps on. It's comical, of course.
What would you say the effect of recording some poetry or the poet's reading poetry has had?
Oh, well, it has involved readers in the whole poetic process as never before. Oh, heavens. when you actually hear Eliot or Joyce or Dylan Thomas reading that stuff, why, it makes you feel that it's a normal part of human speech and behavior to be poetic. Oh, sure. And I think you can really translate the word creative or poetic quite simply into probe, and that at all times any creative person is probing, exploring his environment. And the ordinary person doesn't probe. He reposes in the environment. He wraps it around himself like a familiar setting or chair or something. But the poet tends to be a bit of a delinquent, you know, sleuth, Bogart, Bond, explorer. But I heard a Jack Benny show revived recently. Not a Fred Allen show. I'd like to hear a Fred Allen show again. What amazed me about the Jack Benny revival show was the tremendous speed with which he delivered his gags and his words. Very hi-fi, very fast. Whereas now, since TV, he's slowed down. He smiles slow. No hurry. The fast gag man of the radio days couldn't exist on TV.
You know, an interesting comparison of two shows. Norman Corwin did a thing called On a Note of Triumph. It was written to be played the night after the end of the war. It was all symbolic, all poetry and so forth. You listen to that today, it leaves you cold. You listen to an actuality broadcast of the British, that the British made, a whole series of records, you're as involved in that as if it were happening today. It's all reality material.
What sort of a broadcaster was it, the reality broadcast?
Well, the reality broadcasts are interviews with the people on the battlefield, the sounds of the battle, and so forth. The other is poetry and music relating
to it.
Well,
it's packaged. The reality broadcasting, you see, isn't packaged. And packaging really means putting something around something. It's container corp. But in England, before the war, the thing grew up. Alec Comfort, the poet, was one of the inspirers of the movement called Mass Observation, in which the sort of reality broadcasting was done. They had teams of people who were simply going out, talking to people casually in ordinary situations about what was happening. And that idea of the informal, the unpackaged, but the Corwins, or the, who's the old voice of NBC, or from the Victory at Sea? Oh, who's he still around?
You're not thinking Murrow and Friendly here. No.
The voice that they used on the Victory at Sea.
By the way, the Orson Welles broadcast of that invasion from Mars, I remember hearing it the night it was on, and I have a recording of that program that I listened to just a few months ago. It is so ridiculous and so uninvolving now, and yet it had the country in its clutches at that moment.
Yeah, but
there again is style.
Well, I'll come around to something like that in a moment. You know Glenn Gould. Did I get
yes,
that?
Yes, I saw that piece, and I felt that he was searching for something, but he had so many errors in that. He was, he is still related to his performance of music.
He
was recognizing certain problems.
He feels that the concert hall, though, is not the right place for the performer anymore. But I'm sure he hasn't straightened out all the...
Yeah, but I don't think he's as free as Jimmy in saying, let's go out into the street the bus terminal or let's...
Oh, quite true. Oh, he's still a very academic performer. One of the areas that we might be able to illustrate on June 27 would be the effect of sound on changing photographic methods. When sound movies came in, it changed the whole photographic pitch. And the difference we're talking about between radio and TV sound, between involving and uninvolving, is a difference between silence and talkies regarding the photography. The photography, as far as I've noticed, had to be stepped up to much higher intensity with sound. You see, when you're listening to sounds, you form as a visual track all the time. And when you're looking at pictures, you form a soundtrack all the time. The human being provides one.
I bought Coda TV last week, and I noticed a fantastic difference between the two. First off, I put the two of them in front of my daughter and asked which one would you like. She picks the color.
Uh-huh.
But apart from that, I find that the people that I used to watch the Johnny Carson show late at night, the people were celebrities on the black and white. On color, they're real people. I can see the shading, I can see the skin, I see them as real people. I can see the color of their lips and so forth, as opposed to black and white, where I supply an image of them. I supply the rest of the image in my feelings.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that they are more real as people and less of this great figure with color.
By the way, there's a phrase, this might have some use.
Has the message changed?
Has the message changed? My relation to it has changed.
It's a new medium.
It's much easier.
It's not the old medium.
It's much easier on my eyes.
Color is not the old medium. It's a brand new medium. It will change everything, including the content, in a short time. That's where Batman came from. The new color medium requires the cartoon world, not pictures. And you see, there's a phrase. There's a phrase, well, TV.
Why do you say that?
Well, there's a phrase, what is called information theory. It's not a very useful phrase because it misleads people. Information theorists will say, in a photograph, there is no information, too many data. In a cartoon, lots of information, very few data. What they mean by information is structure, just outline. Now, TV is by comparison with photography, is information. It's cartoon.
Something you did at your Channel 13 thing gave me an idea that I bet would blow a certain type of commercial apart. Remember you had that drawing of the outline shapes of people and the numbers in them? Remember that one? You know, for instance, Life magazine will have a picture of 30 people, the graduating class of Cornell of 1914. Then they will have a little drawing of just the shapes of the people standing there with numbers and their names below it.
Yeah.
All right. You take these testimonial commercials, and you take and just have the outline of the person, and they're talking about how it cured their headache. You will find that people will be much more involved than seeing the person really in full camera, you know, full picture, telling about their headache. Because they can paint their own picture of the person the other way in that shape. They will also find that it will not be a specific person, but it'll be, if the sound is convincing and real, it'll say that this is anybody and it's real. Whereas the other way, it becomes just one person and real. And it's a totally different.
But you see, the reason the kids will buy cartoons any time ahead of picture books is just that. So much has been left out. There's big space for them to get in.
Ambiguity. That's
another way of getting into the act. You see, the clear, distinct, precise scientific statement leaves no room for anybody to get in. Stay away. It excludes. Anything specialist and intense excludes. Now, the cartoon includes. And color includes even more than black and white because, you see, the eye, it is the periphery of the eye that sees black and white and movement. The center of the eye, the cones, see color. And that's much more involving than movement and black and white. So color will have a complete transform the whole programming of TV eventually, and will change. It's a new environment too in the outside world. And
it affects the way you see.
And have you watched the fire in black and white and the fire in color on TV?
No, I haven't seen anything like that. What do you mean, the fire?
A fire.
A
building burning down.
But it reminds me of Johnny Cage's remark, remember? When in trouble in New York, the cops told Johnny.
That was your mark.
You told me. Ah, well, now look. I'd like to be able to track that down a little further, just in case.
I told you that a cop one day told me that if you ask for, if you yell help, if you're in a lobby and someone comes up and attacks you and you yell help, he says, no one will come. He says, yell fire, and all the doors will open.
That's right. Now, you see, this is...
Well, I didn't do that, but I wanted to bring out some images.
But you see,
this
is a nice way of getting it hot and cool. Well, the yelling help is cool and is involving. And nobody wants to get involved anymore. They're already involved far too much. But if you say fire, they'll rush in because there's no involvement there. You just put the fire up and beat it.
Well, I saw it on another...
Literature is black and white. It's very hard to see color in literature. But Max and Gorky has an essay on fire. And you see color in that entire goddamn essay.
Yeah, well, that could be.
Now, I would like to put
color.
The image of a building burning down in color...
Yeah.
In front of your eyes in black and white, and I'd like to see how you react to that.
Uh-huh. Oh, well, my reaction wouldn't be any different from anybody's reaction.
I have the idea that one is a danger you're staying away from.
Well, it's literally, the funny thing is, here's a pun in a nonverbal form. The fire is really saying a very hot situation does not involve people. They get back. They don't feel involved. Help means you must hurry in here and involve yourself.
Well, that's only one aspect of what's going on. Because, look, realistically, if someone yells fire, I want to not be in danger. If they yell help, there's the chance of my being in danger.
Of course, but that's involvement. Now, when they yell help, that means they want you to get involved in their life.
Yes, the involvement I accept...
Well, no, most people don't accept it. They don't want to have anything to do with it.
What I mean by accepting is that I accept that part of your statement. The other part of the...
Fire? You mean you might...
come out because of the fire because they want to protect themselves.
But the protection takes the form of detaching themselves. Don't you see? As in any hot medium, you detach yourself. You become objective. You become a spectator. You don't get involved.
Yes, but
the more you hot up,
this house is burning down. I want to get the hell out of it.
That's not involvement. You see, it's a hot medium that
you
want to. That's all right. But that's true of all hot media. You want to get away from them.
Yeah.
That's the point. So the.
That's why they say shut off that radio.
Yeah, that's hot.
You want to get away from it.
No, but the reason that people will help with a fire. Is quite simply, of course, they don't want to get involved in a fire, in the sense that it might surround them. On the other hand, a fire is a very impersonal thing, whereas a person in need of help is in a very personal problem. And fire is not personal. It's purely objective. You rush in with an extinguisher or anything available, and you put it out. But there's no personal involvement.
How about fire as an object of art? Suppose I had a fire museum. You'd come in and immediately I'd be burning wood.
Yeah,
and then I'd
be
burning sulfur.
Wonderful.
It'd be a beautiful thing. I'd have every.
You could have a great spectrum of experiences. But there's in music. There's a great range of fire music.
Isn't it possible that we react to fire with feelings that we never knew we had before?
No, from the time you first burned your fingers, you have all sorts of feelings available for fire.
But isn't a feeling for fire something that might be handed down in our genes?
Oh, no. It may be, but it isn't necessary to suppose that. It's quite simply that physically you try to get away from it as much as possible. And any hot form of experience invites people to get away. By the way, there's a famous old story about the north wind and the sun decided to have a little battle about who could exert the most power on something. I read this since I was literally in grade one. And the north wind blew like fury, and the guy merely tightened up his clothes on. Then the sun came out and beamed on him, and off went the clothes. But, the hot is much more inclined to get people... away, detached. Print is hot. It detaches people. Handwriting is not hot. It involves people. It's cool.
You know, I wanted to have a message on a commercial, and I just wanted to have the hand writing the message over the picture. Just writing it.
That's TV. The scanning finger is writing on the wall.
If you were to pick up a bottle on a shoreline, and you pulled out a typewritten message with the word help, you wouldn't be as involved as a handwritten message. I think it's a circumstance.
If you want to work at that, strictly, that's the red herring department, which you might well encounter on the seashore. But the bottle, you see, the bottle, the message in a bottle is like something overheard, not heard. Something
is
overheard.
That what we want in advertising?
That,
feeling of this?
Oh, just a moment.
Wouldn't you drop in Life magazine a handwritten ad to get this guy?
Just a moment. The overheard message, if you hear somebody in the barbershop saying something to somebody about something terrific, that has a far greater effect than somebody telling you something.
Would you let me do one of my columns in handwriting in your magazine?
Yes.
Okay, I'll do
the overheard is far